We're spending the hour on the state of our democracy. That's Democratic Views with a small d and the threats to it. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A moment here from President Biden's voting rights speech in Atlanta this week.
Hear me plainly. The battle for the soul of America is not over. We must stand strong and stand together to make sure January 6th marks not the end of democracy, but the beginning, a renaissance of our democracy.
We are in times of democratic anxiety over norms and civil liberties. What does history tell us? How are you feeling about our nation's democracy? 800-642-1234. Juliana Shamidez is an associate professor of European International History at UW-Madison, studies global history, the place of Europe in the wider world. Juliana, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. We also have Steve Kantrowitz, who's a history professor at UW-Madison. His scholarship is at the intersection of race, politics, citizenship. Stephen, welcome back to you.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start by taking a temperature reading here from both of you first about what worries you about American democracy at the moment. And thinking about former President Jimmy Carter writing an op-ed in the New York Times saying we are at risk of losing our precious democracy. Steve, what worries you?
Ooh, a great deal. I think that we have challenges to people's ability to make their democratic voices heard, to the fair counting of their votes. And on a deeper level, I think a greater skepticism about the value of democracy than I've seen in my lifetime.
On that last note, on the value of it, what do you mean by that? Because value can mean many things.
Well, what I mean by that is that there was a time earlier in my life, in the 20th century, even in the early 21st century, when the United States represented itself as a kind of a beacon for democratic aspiration, and the countries that we looked to in the world to encourage were those moving toward democracy, and those that we sought to discourage were those moving away from democracy. But just in the last couple of years, we've watched this romance with European autocrats in a way that runs totally counter to that part of my experience of the 20th and early 21st century, and that's really worrying to me in terms of what it says about our broader commitments to democracy at home.
And that leads right to Juliana, who you have your eye abroad so much, so deeply. How worried are you about what you see here in the U.S.?
Thanks, Kate. I am moderately worried. I am concerned about the attack on voter rights. I'm concerned about the increased power of states to potentially determine how votes end up. But I think from the beginning, American democracy has been a work in progress. There have been struggles, deep struggles, important struggles from the beginning over how to define who belongs in this country and who does not, who has full rights within this country and who does not. And there have been struggles from the beginning regarding what I would call American imperialism, both within this country and beyond its borders. I think these struggles are longstanding, and we've reached a critical juncture in various respects, but I actually don't see this current moment as radically more worrisome than other moments in American history.
I want to pick up on those values because I was reading one scholar said we used to be considered a full democracy, like a Norway, like a Iceland, Switzerland, and now we're a partial democracy, perhaps more like a Haiti or a Somalia. What do you see there? I mean, can you say we're akin? Where are we on this thermostat, if you will, of what is full democracy versus partial democracy, Juliana?
That's an excellent question and a very complicated one. What I see as the biggest threat right now is the undermining of democratic institutions from within. Mm. And here's where I see historical analogy as being very relevant for us, because in my studies on the history of European fascism, we see a similar phenomenon taking place in the 1920s and the 1930s, where it wasn't the case that Mussolini and Hitler rose to power through very dramatic coups. That's a common misunderstanding. In fact, they rose to power through the somewhat broken mechanisms of Italian and German democratic systems. And that's where I think we need to be really vigilant and careful and understand that democracies can be eroded from within if we aren't careful about protecting our institutions and creating forms of civil discourse that can bridge divides.
If you're just joining us, we're spending this hour reflecting on the state of our democracy with UW-Madison history professors Juliana Shamidas and Steve Kantrowitz. You can join in. Are you worried about what you see? What do you see as the threat? Do you think that partisan identity now dwarfs whatever shared identity we had as Americans? 800-642-1234. Mary is joining us from Pewaukee. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi, I agree with both of the historians. I'm kind of wondering, a question would be, has a former president ever been indicted for his actions, as I feel our former president, 45 I call him, should be? Absolutely. White supremacy also, my comment, is real, and an extreme terror and our top number one thing that we need to take care of. And Biden's speech was powerful and strong, and that's what leads me to hope for our future if we continue to vote as Americans who are against this breaking down of our democracy.
Mary, thank you for those observations. And Mary, bringing up multiple themes here, Steve, I want to toss this to you on Mary's reflections here.
Yeah, Mary brings up a really important part of this history, and that is white supremacy. At the outset, the United States was, the question when the United States became a republic was not, should we have full democracy or not? The question was, would any form of democracy work? And the form that the constitutional framers came up with was pretty radically hedged in, very limited democracy in some ways. You know, the people entitled to vote had to have some combination of property ownership, being male, being white, although There were lots of people who were not white who could vote in the early republic. But one of the things that happened as democratization accelerated in the 19th century until Reconstruction, until the 1860s, is that movements to expand the right to vote for white men almost always came at the cost of votes for black men. That is, democratization for white people came at the expense of black people's voting rights. And so from the very beginning, democratic forces in the United States and the problem of democracy in the United States has been wrapped around the history of white supremacy. And we can see this both in the way that African-Americans learned to articulate a critique of the United States and a way of imagining themselves into full belonging and full citizenship in the United States, and the way that has always been responded to with skepticism, hostility, and violence.
And there are nods to the American Civil War, as we talk about what we are seeing today, and even polling that voting age Americans under 30 in this Harvard Kennedy School poll said they expected there to be a civil war in their lifetimes. And, you know, I understand, you know, talk is one thing, action is another, and take polls with a grain of salt. But, you know, I mean, this is not the 1860s. This is not Southern states leaving the Union over slavery. And yet there are these analogies. And I'm wondering, Steve, what do you make of that?
So I've been teaching the history of the United States Civil War here at UW-Madison for 25 years. So I have a few more thoughts about this than will fit into your program. But look, we're not, as you very aptly put it, we are not in the situation we were in 1860 and 61. This is not a regional division over the question of the future of slavery. So whatever form of conflict could emerge in the United States would not look anything like the conflict that we call the Civil War. That said, we have some pretty profound divisions. They are organized more and more around partisan identification, not regional identification. And that is very worrying for different reasons and with different implications than the struggles of the 1830s and 40s and 50s that led directly to the Civil War. So, you know, we could talk about what those partisan divisions look like and how they manifest and how they could become violent, but it's not going to look like the Civil War of the 1860s, no matter what happens.
UW-Madison historians Steve Kantrowitz there, Juliana Shamidez study government structures and struggles here and abroad, respectively. Do you think that the last election was stolen, or are you worried that future elections will be illegitimate? Do you think that partisan identity, that it overshadows whatever shared identity we have as Americans? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking to history to inform the state of our American government today, our political polarization, how people and parties rise to power. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NPR's Steve Inskeep, he interviewed former President Trump this week, who hung up while being questioned about his continued lies about the 2020 election, but not before saying this.
If you look at the numbers, if you look at the findings in Arizona, if you look at what's going on in Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, by the way, and take a look at Wisconsin, they're finding things that nobody thought possible. This was a corrupt election.
And the fact is, the Legislative Audit Bureau found no widespread voter fraud or wrongdoing in Wisconsin elections. President Biden won our state by about 21,000 votes. Are you worried that our country's democracy is failing? 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison historians Juliana Shamidez and Stephen Kantrowitz who are with us for the hour. Let's go to Gary now in Boscobel. Gary, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One is, if the forces that are pushing back against the conservatives in this country disappeared, what do the conservatives want? What is their vision of America as they see it? I am, you know, I've been painted as a liberal, as drinking baby's blood and deeply involved in child trafficking. And these things hurt me to the very core of my being. And I really find I have no empathy for what happens to the conservatives. And also, are we overlooking a group in society, in our social structure here that from what I've read, is having a profound effect on our democracy, and that is the evangelicals, especially the Southern evangelicals.
And Gary, broadening there, but I mean, I think you were trying to get at the heart here of autocratic rule and what, you know, why it is something that is, you know, why is there such support for autocratic rule? And I want to throw that to Juliana. Go ahead.
Thank you, Gary, for this question. As I see it, there's broad support for autocratic rule in countries that are suffering through a combination of economic crisis, political crisis, and extreme polarization. And we are seeing features of all of those three things here within the United States. And we did see those three phenomena within Europe in the 1920s and 1930s. One thing to keep in mind is that the strategy of dividing and conquering the electorate and pitting one group against the other and caricaturing the differences between different groups and even painting it as a struggle between two groups as opposed to what is the reality of a very complex world of different political ideals and identities vying against one another. I think all of these strategies are strategies that are tried and true authoritarian strategies. They were strategies that the fascists employed in the 1920s and 30s. And they are slippery slopes, because when you begin to dehumanize those who may think a little bit differently from you, you begin to justify and rationalize violence against those people, the deportation and elimination of those people from your political community, and so forth. So as I see it, we need to be very vigilant ourselves about demonizing those who may think differently from how we do.
But
I can jump on the religion question later.
Okay, but help me out with this, because authoritarianism, that is a blanket term. That's a broad word encompassing very different governments around the world. But if I understand correctly, it has one thing in common, that your transfer of power is not free and fair elections. Is there something to that? Is that right?
That's absolutely correct, Kate. I would add to that that authoritarian leaders tend to present themselves as the voices of the popular will while they are eroding democratic institutions. So they, in some strange sense, present themselves as the ultimate Democrats.
I see. Steve, do you want to jump in here on authoritarianism, what you see here in America?
Yeah, I would actually like to go back to step back even a little further than that and say that what Juliana had to say very aptly, I think, about us against them and the way that dehumanization follows from a certain kind of deliberate and intentional polarization is made much worse by the structures of the United States democratic system. And that is, our winner-take-all elections produce a two-party system. And in a country of this size, that's no longer as profoundly divided by region as it once was, the way those divisions manifest is as political polarization, in which literally a substantial plurality of the country regards another substantial plurality of the country as illegitimate, as fundamentally illegitimate, and therefore perhaps not entitled to govern. I think the challenge to democracy right now is really profound, because just as during the last third of the 19th century, there's a substantial fraction of the country that just doesn't think that that elected Democrats should be allowed to govern.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about democracy. Is it in danger? We have UW-Madison history professors Steve Kantrowitz and Juliana Chamidez. You can join in as we look at values, as we look at what is at stake. Let's go to Katie in Eau Claire. Katie, hi. What is on your mind?
Hi there. I think, honestly, my original question was answered. Which is what you guys were just talking about. But an additional question that I have is, this isn't a shift that has happened overnight. There had to be some sort of a lead into this. And at what point in our history did we start to see this sort of shift in modern politics become so divisive and become so partisan? Is there a time period? Is there a moment, an event that kind of shifted this? I just kind of wanted to get an example of when this sort of started.
Katie, thank you. Steve, could you illuminate?
If I had to identify the moment that has led to this form of polarization that we're in right now, I'd have to say it's the civil rights movement. Because the civil rights movement uncorked the bottle of African-American political aspiration that had been choked off in the late 19th century. And when that happened, several generations of a political status quo were upended, and the political parties shifted in response, and people's attitudes and identifications shifted in response. And what we've seen now is a backlash against the civil rights movement that's as powerful, though not yet as successful, as the backlash against Reconstruction that produced the Jim Crow era. Now, The difference is that we're living in a much, in many ways, a much more integrated world and a much less caste-defined world than we were in the late 19th century. And so it's not just African-Americans and their close political allies who are regarded as illegitimate, but anyone who takes up the banner of the civil rights movement and its sequels, who is represented as fundamentally at odds with a certain kind of thinking about democracy.
UW Madison historian Steve Kantrowitz there, Juliana Shamidez are helping us understand the state of our democratic values through history, through a historical lens. With you, we'll pick this conversation up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. A quick programming note here. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us for the morning show. Join us here on the Ideas Network for special programming on Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday, the 17th. It's a rebroadcast of the 2021 official Wisconsin celebration and tribute that's hosted by WPR's Dr. Jonathan Overby, and that is Monday at noon. Find out more at WPR.org. Now to the anti-democratic movement undergirded by the patently false statement that President Biden didn't win the election. Attorney General Merrick Garland, he spoke on the eve of the January 6th Capitol riot anniversary, urging Americans to have faith in the process without naming Trump.
The Justice Department, even the Congress, cannot alone defend the right to vote. The responsibility to preserve democracy and to maintain faith in the legitimacy of its essential processes lies with every elected official and with every American.
Courtesy there, C-SPAN, what do you make of political and social divisions? Are they hurting our governance? 800-642-1234. Juliana Shamidez is an associate professor of European International History at UW-Madison. Steve Kantrowitz, her colleague, UW-Madison history professor studying race, politics, citizenship as well. They're here for the hour. Let's bring on Sarah now in Chippewa. Sarah, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. This wasn't the initial comment that I was going to make, but I'll quickly make it. That I just wanted to say that I find it irresponsible for the speaker to actually blame a backlash on civil rights as the problem.
Sarah, you're breaking up there. Can you still hear us?
Excuse me?
Okay. Oh, now we can hear you. You were breaking up there. Go. Say that again. Yes, Sarah, we're unable to hear you now, perhaps going through a difficult area. But I do want to go back to Steve here and not blaming it on civil rights. And I'm not sure exactly where Sarah was going with this, Steve. But one thing that hasn't come up here is the rights of states, the rights of Texas to do its thing, to succeed. This has been an issue since the founding, and you can see it in abortion right access now in states, how voting rights access in states. How do you see states' rights fitting into the erosion of democratic values?
Can I first just respond to what I imagine that Sarah was trying to say?
Yes, which was, please.
Because I apologize to her in advance if I'm misunderstanding her. So this is just my interpretation of the beginning of the comment that I could hear. It's possible to read what I said previously as blaming the civil rights movement for the backlash, and that is not my purpose, of course. But rather that the civil rights movement profoundly challenged a tradition of white supremacy in the United States. And that tradition turned out and turns out to be enormously powerful and to have lasting effects. And we're engaged and have been engaged for more than two centuries now in a struggle over whether the people meant the white people or all the people in the United States. And that is one of the essential struggles in U.S. history. To turn to the question that you just formulated about states' rights, on one level, you know, the Civil War resolved this question. The Civil War resolved the question of whether states can just take their ball and go home. And the answer is no, they can't. The more complex question is, to what degree can states limit or erode rights that have been established as national rights? Mm-hmm. And this is what we're seeing now with the Texas anti-abortion law and with a series of other activities from different states. We have a very complicated federal system. It provides for lots of authority and discretion at the state level and sometimes at the local level, as well as for kind of uniform federal rights and powers. But the question is, how much can states intrude on what we understand to be fundamental national rights? Mm-hmm. And the Civil War also sought to resolve that question. And that's really what the 14th Amendment was devised to do, is to say, no, in fact, the states cannot interfere with fundamental rights. And so from that perspective, in the broadest sense, I'm not a constitutional lawyer or a constitutional scholar, but in the broadest sense, we have also, at least in principle, resolved that question constitutionally. As with so many other things, people will keep pushing to see where they can find the weak points and the pressure points to accomplish their political ends.
Juliana, what do you see abroad there with states or even perhaps the Vatican pushing back?
Sure. So to answer the question about American democracy and its fault lines, I think one crucial point that hasn't come up yet is the Supreme Court. And as I see it, it's really an institution that's crying out to be reformed, because ideally this is one of the pillars that's balancing power in this country and ensuring that we have some sort of balance between majoritarian rule and state rule. And so here I really think it's crucial for us to put the conversation about reforming the structures of the Supreme Court front and center. When we look out internationally, I actually wanted to add something to Steve's earlier comment about the civil rights movement as a turning point.
Yes.
And that is another key turning point was the mobilizations against the Vietnam War and really rethinking the United States' role in the world, challenging some of what were then the Cold War orthodoxies and reimagining a different kind of U.S. presence in the world. And there was a huge backlash against that as well. And the form of nationalism that was repurposed and reproposed in response to the anti-Vietnam War mobilizations, I see is something that we're still really wrestling with today.
You still see those repercussions today. Let's go to Jesse now in Fontana. Jesse, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hello. How are you doing today?
Doing well.
My comment in regards to, are we divided? Yes, the United States of America is divided now. Republicans chose to run elections on divide and conquer, dividing people. And how do I know that? Well, it's going to affect, it's affecting a bunch of people in general. And I know it because, born in Texas and have traveled in 64 countries, it's the first time in 2-3 years that I'm being started to ask in Wisconsin and Illinois, where are you from? Do you speak other language? Were you born here? I was born in Texas. My family has been in this country way before this was the United States of America, 1601. And when I hear those comments or questions towards me, it's like, what is happening? What is really happening? And yes, both parties are responsible for dividing to try to get their own agenda. And we need to control that. Otherwise, we're going to have bigger problems, and it's going to affect everybody. everybody. The way I see it, there's more democracy in Russia today than there is in our own country. It's shameful.
Jesse, thank you. Thank you, Jesse, for calling in. Juliana, you first. What is coming up as you hear Jesse?
Jesse, thank you so much for your call. And this is really horrible that you suddenly feel like a stranger in your own country. I think part of why this is going on does very much have to do with recent developments with the imposition of xenophobic travel restrictions starting from 2017, with the normalization of racism from the highest echelons in this country. That said, I do also think that we've been struggling from the beginning as a country with issues of inclusion and exclusion, and this is an ongoing process. And as I see it, the use of comparing the degree of racism and polarization that is going on today to history, to moments like the rise of fascism, is hopefully to serve as a real wake-up call so that we can realize the gravity of the situation, but also the fact that this is also a U.S. problem, right? As Steve Kantorowicz has been emphasizing, we from the beginning have a history of white supremacy that needs to be faced and grappled with and discussed and addressed and redressed. So let's wake up to the gravity of the situation, but let's also understand that we have been working through these problems for a long time, and we have a lot of work ahead before we solve them.
Steve, Jesse's the things that Jesse has asked, were you born here? I mean, that really echoes what you have been saying here all along, I imagine, that Jesse is bringing up.
Yeah. You know, one of the courses I teach at UW-Madison is called Who is an American? And one of the things that I cover in that class is precisely the question that Jesse has just encountered, which is, where are you from? No, where are you really from? And when I bring that topic up in the classroom, I watch my students of Asian and Hispanic descent nod vigorously, because all of them, whether they were born in the United States, whether their families have lived in the United States for generations, or whether they are immigrants, have confronted that question repeatedly throughout their lives. And it's a wake-up call for the other students in the room to realize that other people don't take their belonging for granted. And I think if we're gonna create a more robust and inclusive democracy in this country, people who are not accustomed to asking that, to thinking that thought and experiencing those questions, are going to have to think about those questions a little bit more. And I'm sorry, like Juliana, I'm sorry that Jesse has encountered that and had that experience. I think it's a very common experience, unfortunately. And I think the more people who can acknowledge and consider that problem, the better.
UW-Madison historians Steve Kantorowicz and Juliana Chamidez have scholarship in areas that touch on government structure and the transformation of citizenship, social justice here in the U.S., abroad. Still time to talk about these themes coming up for you as you think about a fragile democracy, tracing its roots, where we go from here. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're with UW-Madison historians Juliana Chamidez and Steve Kantorowicz as we look at the past as a guide to how governments function here and abroad. Pew Research Center says their surveys consistently reveal around the world in many countries that large shares of the public are dissatisfied with the way democracy is working. Do you share that sentiment? The professors are with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Jack now in Cedarburg. Jack, hi.
Hello, good morning. I totally agree with the guest's comment that the turning point was the civil rights movement, but I think of equal slightly less significance is the advent of the internet, where, you know, pretty much every individual in the entire country has a mobile phone or an iPad, and lies and untruths, half-truths, are spread like wildfire, where they used to be more localized, never, you know, took root. That is a genie that's going to be hard to put back in the bottle. And then add on top of that all of those lies bolstered by the likes of Fox News, Newsmax, et cetera. It's a recipe for disaster, and these bad ideas start to take root.
Jack, thank you. Steve, on technology development, media, misinformation, disinformation.
You know, the I think your guest does just hit the caller's just hit it right on the head here, and I think it's always been the case, as the saying goes, you know, that a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth can get its boots on. But in this case, the lie can get all the way around the world in a matter of seconds, and the truth has very few shoes at all anymore. So as newsrooms close down, and as it becomes harder and harder to distinguish between good faith journalism and bad faith opinion and falsification. And I'm as susceptible to that as anyone. I'm not up on a high horse here. When things come across my feed, I react to them. Mm-hmm. And I react to them often without checking in the way that a historian ought to. And I've had to learn some new behaviors as I encounter social media driven news, in order not to simply be reacting and be thinking instead. But it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. The sorting process is really hard. And I can understand how it is that people fall into rabbit holes that then the algorithms confirm. And that's how we get QAnon. And that's how we get, all of the other really corrosive fantasies that I think are putting our democracy in peril.
Juliana?
Absolutely agree with the caller's sentiment here that we face real danger if we allow social media to shape our understanding of the truth. I would simply add that Mussolini himself, shortly after coming to power, said that the person who lies enough starts to believe their own lies. Mm. And I think we need to really think about that statement, because we need to create a strong form of resistance against the proliferation of lies, not only through our choices as individuals and how we engage on social media, through our own diligence and fact-checking and so forth, but I think we need to think carefully about reinvesting in education in a serious way, and we need to think carefully about rebuilding community organizations and structures where people of different views can encounter one another and have civil discussion in a way that used to happen, say, within the structure of a union, but unions no longer play that sort of role and no longer have the power that they did. So we need to really take very seriously the project of rebuilding spaces of community and civil conversation so that people are checking whatever information they receive through one channel in other domains that are more diverse and subject to conversation and debate.
That's interesting, because I hear echoes of what you're saying with what Attorney General Merrick Garland said in his speech, that it's not just the president or elected officials who matter for assuring free and fair elections. It's all of civil society. It's businesses and churches and unions and civic groups and nonprofits, all of it working together. So, which leads me to asking you, Juliana, what defines a healthy democracy? How do we know when it's working?
That's such a great question, Kate. So, of course, there's an institutional answer to that question, but I'd like to focus instead on the interpersonal and communal aspect. I would say a sign that a democracy is working is when individuals have trust and faith in one another and trust and faith in the political system that is representing them.
How about you, Steve? How do you know that there is a turning point, that a democracy is healthy?
I think Giuliana's definition there is excellent and really useful to think with. The Harvard Youth Poll, which surveys 18 to 29 year olds every year, asked this question, and it turns out that of their very large sample, I think 2,500, only 7% of young people in America believe that this is a healthy democracy. So that's a really important warning sign. Now, if you dig into those numbers, you find that half of those young people think it's in trouble because they believe that the last presidential election was stolen. And that's even more worrying to me, in fact, as a number. So what Julianne is pointing to in terms of the need for trust, or trust as a metric of whether we have a healthy democracy, I think from that point of view, we're in terrible, terrible trouble. So I'm not moderately worried. I'm extremely worried about the state of our democracy for that reason. And I'm not sure where we go to regain that trust. I do think that we need to talk to one another, but I think maybe more importantly, we need to listen to one another. And I'm not sure where the forums now exist for us to do that. And that's partly a function of our having moved our political lives online. That's partly a function of the pandemic, but it's also a function of the sort of profound erosion of the kind of civil society institutions that Giuliana points to. And the erosion of those institutions is not an accident. That's also been a partisan effort to limit the power of labor unions, to reduce the authority and power of educational institutions. It's not an accident. This has happened by design.
Giuliana, can we still center ourselves? Can we pull back from whatever brink we are approaching, or whatever words you have for it? What can we do today to improve our democracy?
I think we can pull back. I think the effort should really be on youth right now and on making sure that we change those numbers that Steve just cited that are in fact deeply worrisome, and figure out spaces for youth to, first of all, articulate what they see as problematic in this country and help them take the lead in developing solutions for some of the mammoth problems that we face, from environmental crisis to racism to various forms of civil society decline. So I think we need to give more voice and listen more carefully to what the next generation is proposing. And they are going to be the ones who I think will give us the tools we need to sort this mess out.
Hearing from our young people, thank you both for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Giuliana Chamidez is an associate professor of European International History at UW-Madison. Steve Kantrowitz, a history professor at UW-Madison as well. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.